The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Well, good morning. It's time to begin. This is a workshop on teaching history through masterpieces of art. My name is Patrick Holbrook. I teach 11th grade modern European history and our 12th grade senior thesis class at Cary Christian School. I just finished my 13th year teaching there. That's usually met with the response, "You don't look like someone who's been teaching there for 13 years." But I'm happy to report this is the first year I wasn't mistaken for a high schooler, so I guess that's a good thing. I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to speak today and for your coming to hear this talk. I want you to think about if you were to list out key components of what an ideal high-quality classical Christian education should include. I think there's probably two things that most of us would put on that list. One, we want our students to develop a clear vision of history. We want them to understand the trajectory of Western civilization and the ideas and the values that have defined it from age to age. And we also want our students to be drawn toward and to appreciate all things that are good and true and beautiful. And of course, that includes knowing and loving great works of art, to have the ability to, which not everyone can do, but have the ability to stand in front of a masterpiece by Rembrandt or by Raphael and to be delighted and awed by it. And so my goal today is to explore some of the ways that we as teachers can combine these goals by integrating the study of history and art in a way that enriches students' understanding of both of these subjects. I'm curious, how many of you in here are primarily history teachers, or at least dabble in history? Okay. And then art teachers? I have some art teachers? Okay, great. I'm a history teacher, so I'm coming at it from that perspective, but I think that what you can do with this, you can easily implement in an art class, or even a literature class, or if you have a general humanities or omnibus class, then it could be relevant for that as well, and you're probably already doing something like this. I did want to mention, if you're interested in getting a copy of these PowerPoint slides, I'd be happy to email them to you. My email address is on the top of the outline, pholbrook@carychristianschool.org. I know that, unfortunately, the setup of this room isn't ideal. I wish I could move this about 10 feet higher so everyone could see a little better, but if you want to take a look at those later, like I said, I'll be glad to send it to you. I want to start by sharing a little bit of background that is relevant, that plays into how I teach. In my history classes, sometimes we study so much art that I think my students suspect I'm confused about what class I'm really supposed to be teaching. And for that reason, they're surprised when I tell them that growing up, I didn't really like art. I should have, because I grew up in Fairfax, Virginia, right outside D.C., which meant in elementary school we had some of the best field trips. We'd see dinosaur bones in a natural history museum. We'd see all the great stuff at the Air and Space Museum. And we had the National Gallery of Art right there. For some reason, I only ever remember going to the modern art part of that museum. If you've been there, you know there's the East and the West building, and we would just go to the East building, and we'd see all the contemporary stuff. And I have vague memories of a second grade field trip where we went to the, there's some splendid pieces, went to the East building, and I remember sort of vaguely things like these big hanging mobiles, Alexander Calder, and these canvases with paint just splashed all over them, Jackson Pollock's, and these weird little things where they cut pieces of paper out and put them on something, which Henri Matisse, of course. But I also remember going back to school, and in the next day in art class, guess what we did? We made great art. So you get your construction paper and your second grade scissors, and you cut stuff out, and it looks just like that, and I couldn't really tell the difference. And it was kind of fun as a second grader, but somewhere in my mind I was concluding, okay, so if you grow up to be an artist, that basically means you do second grade arts and crafts all day. I remember the tour guide excitedly telling us about in Jackson Pollock's art, somewhere you can see, here's where the fly got stuck, and he just left it there. Here's where he flicked his cigarette butt in, and it's still there. So we weren't doing that in second grade, but I don't think that was an irrational conclusion to come to, but I just say all this to say that I didn't know what was going on when it came to art. Now, at some point, I went over to the other building and discovered what I'd been missing, but it really wasn't until college that things started making sense. Two things that happened. First, I started taking some humanities classes, and I didn't even really know what the word humanities meant when I signed up, but I soon learned that what humanities means, at least in an academic setting, is doing connect the dots. You have philosophy and theology and sculpture and architecture and political science and all these realms of human knowledge and creation, and you see how they're connected. And you understand the relationship between Thomas Aquinas and the cathedrals. And you can see why America, when you walk down the streets of D.C., you see these Greek temples everywhere with presidents in them. It started finally making some degree of sense. The other thing that helped me a great deal in college is when I discovered Francis Schaeffer. I'd never heard of him before college. His books were introduced to me by my wife, who had attended a private Christian school and read him. She wasn't my wife yet, but, you know, this was part of the appeal. My humanities classes had helped me to make connections between different things, but what Schaeffer gave me was more of a Christian vision of how to evaluate what I was seeing. And I was struck by the opening sentences of his book, How Should We Then Live? This quote's on your outline. And he wrote, there is a flow to history and culture. This flow is rooted and has its wellspring in the thoughts of people. People are unique in the inner life of the mind. What they are in their thought world determines how they act. This is true of their value systems, and it's true of their creativity. It's true of their corporate actions, such as political decisions, and it's true of their personal lives. The results of their thought world flow through their fingers or from their tongues into the external world. This is true of Michelangelo's chisel, and it is true of a dictator's sword. So what Schaeffer did in his books and in that great quirky video series he made in the 70s is to approach the history of Western culture from that perspective. And today I'm not planning on going through everything that he says, but I do want to say that what he says shapes how I teach. And if you've read Schaeffer, then there's a good chance that that's the case with you as well. He had an ambitious project. He was bound to get a few details wrong. I think he did, but it's that vision of history in which all human life and all of its expressions manifests a worldview. And that as Christians, God calls on us to recognize and interpret every aspect of human culture accordingly. In our classroom, studying art gives us a great opportunity to do that. Kenneth Clark said, all art is founded on faith. In the words of Hans Ruckmacher, art tries literally to picture the things which philosophy tries to put into carefully thought out words. So what I want to do the next few minutes is we're going to start by exploring three eras of history. We're going to look at the Renaissance, the French Revolution, and the 19th century, and the Industrial Revolution. And then I want to wrap up the last 10, 15 minutes with a few practical ideas about activities that we can do with our students. So let's start by spending a few minutes in the Italian Renaissance as we travel to Italy and as we go to the Sistine Chapel. Now, this is, of course, the age of the Renaissance. And like any era of history, we want our students to know not just the basic facts and dates and names, but to really comprehend the character and the values of that age. So, in the age of the Renaissance, which, of course, is literally the rebirth of Greco-Roman culture, the key question is, how do we relate Christianity with classical thought? Right? That's the question that that people in the Renaissance are struggling with? That's the question we struggle with, too, at classical Christian schools, isn't it? And we want our students to know that that's a question that we wrestle with, and we want them to wrestle with that as well. And the Renaissance gives us a great opportunity to bring that up. Now, there's a lot of directions you can go in the study of the Sistine Chapel. I just want to focus on one thing right now, and that is there are these 12 figures in the slide, the ones in color. There's 12 figures around the ceiling. Originally, Michelangelo was planning to put the 12 apostles there. These are not the 12 apostles. Who are they? Fortunately, he gave them name tags. And so we have, over here, Ezekiel. And then along with Ezekiel, a number of others are also Old Testament prophets. Zechariah, Isaiah, Daniel, Joel, Jonah, and Jeremiah. And interspersed with those figures are five others. And this is a fun lesson to do with students because it confuses them. You know, it's always fun to confuse students because then that raises questions, and then they have, you know, it piques their curiosity. And so Ezekiel, we can read that. That's easy to figure out. And over here we have Delphica. Who is Delphica? I don't remember a Delphica in the, is that in the Apocrypha? What is Delphica? And so I ask students, do you remember a Delphica in the Bible? And they say no. And who is this? But we're a classical school, so they've already taken classical literature and history. And so, you know, maybe with a little trepidation, a student raises their hand and says, is that like Delphi? Like the oracle? The Sibyl? The oracle? Like the one that had something to do with Socrates and with Oedipus? Yes, that's the one. So the question is, who let her in? What's she doing on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel? And that, again, I want to emphasize, that's one of those great moments as a teacher. If you give them answers before they have the questions, right, it's not going to stick with them. If you give them the questions and then the answer, that's a little better. But the best is if you can get them to ask the questions and get them to try to figure out the answers and lead them along. And art's a great way to do that because any piece of art you look at, the artist has 1,000 decisions about how to depict something. And so when you ask, why did the artist do that? There's an opportunity to, okay, you know what? There's a whole story behind that. So let's take a look at that story. In the case of the oracle at Delphi, and she's not the only one. There are five others, or she's one of five who are all Greek. The Cumaean, Erythraean, Libyan, and Persian oracles are all up there too. So what are they doing there? Well, on one level, the answer is simple, right? It's the Renaissance, right? You know, it's the Renaissance, and artists are painting the birth of Venus, and sculptors are sending out poor David in the nude to go fight Goliath, and Renaissance artists are just doing what Renaissance artists do. And that's true, but there's more to the story than that, because if you go back to the history of the early church, one of the big questions they were grappling with as Christianity was expanding geographically beyond the walls of Jerusalem, it was expanding ethnically beyond the Jews to also the Gentiles, and within a few years, the church was predominantly Gentile. And so you have these Gentile theologians asking the question, when God was speaking to the Israelites through the prophets, did he have anything to say to us, or was he just ignoring us altogether? And what many of them concluded, what many of them speculated about, was that maybe God had spoken to the Greeks or Romans or others as well. Clement of Alexandria took Paul's idea in Galatians, where Paul says the law of Moses was a tutor or a pedagogos to lead the Jews to Christ and to prepare them for Christ. And he said, well, maybe God gave the Gentiles a tutor as well. And what if that tutor was philosophy? And the poet Virgil also provoked a great deal of speculations for a lot of reasons. Ask Louis Marcos about him. There's a lot. And one of them in particular was that he had written some things that, well, listen to this. A new human race is descending from the heights of heaven. This would be brought about by the birth of a child with whom the golden age of humanity would begin. In context, he was writing about the Pax Romana and Augustus Caesar, but doesn't that sound like Jesus and the gospel? And maybe that was some kind of clue, perhaps? And then there's this text. Listen to this one. Sounding the archangel's trumpet shall peal down from the heaven over the wicked who groan in their guilt and their manifold sorrows. Trembling, the earth shall be opened, revealing chaos and hell. Every kind before God shall stand in that day to be judged. Rivers of fire and brimstone shall fall from the heavens. These lines were supposedly written by one of the Greek sibyls. And the most intriguing part for the early Christians is that it formed an acrostic, which, taking the first letter of each line, spelled out Jesus Christ, Son of God, Savior, Ichthus, right, fish. Augustine even buys into that interpretation. And so you look at, there's a number of others too. If you look at the book Jesus Through the Centuries by Yaroslav Pelikan, he goes into a number of them. Even so far as seeing the gospel in Homer, when Oedipus is tied to the mast of the ship to protect him from the sirens. You know, this wooden mast is a symbol of the cross somehow. And not all the early Christians believed that, but many of them did. And so when we get to the 16th century, okay, you're Michelangelo, you're painting the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, you want to represent people who anticipated the Messiah. And in this tradition, and with the approval of the Catholic Church at the time, who are you going to put up there? Well, how about some, we'll put more Old Testament prophets and sibyls. Okay, we got 7 verses 5. But this is why he's doing what he does. Okay, so there's a lot more we could say about that, but I want us to see that just by examining just this small part of the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, there's two things that we can do with our students. One, just by looking at what's there and being curious about it, we find ourselves surprised by what we see, and that opens the door for a journey through church history. And then second, Michelangelo is also prompting us to evaluate ourselves, right? Here we are at a classical Christian school. By the very nature of our existence, we're saying something about the relationship between Christianity and classical culture. How do we do that? Right? How do we make it work without going too far one way or the other? And you could even have, if you look at Francis Schaeffer, he actually has a very negative view of this. He sees it as opening up the door to humanism and secularism. Whereas read something by, say, Louis Marcos, and he gets kind of excited about this is kind of cool. So that could be an interesting comparison right there. Before we move on from the Renaissance, there's one more work we need to mention a little more briefly, just because I would lose my credentials as a classical educator if I didn't bring up the School of Athens. A number of years ago, I was here for one of these conferences, and I was in the hotel gym, and I saw a guy on a treadmill wearing a t-shirt that had the School of Athens all over it, and I thought, I know what group he's with. So the School of Athens, of course, is this magnificent fresco by Raphael that features philosophy's Hall of Fame. We have Plato and Aristotle in the middle. You can have fun identifying all of the other people around there as well. And what I want to point out, though, with the School of Athens is simply that here we can see the same thing, or at least something similar to what we saw in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, which is pagan philosophy or culture juxtaposed with Christians. We have philosophers and theologians. Now, hang on. There aren't any Christian theologians in that image, so where am I getting the point? Where am I getting this point? They're actually there. They just happen to be on the other side of the room. Pretty much everyone knows about the School of Athens. Not everybody. I'm sure many of you do, but maybe some of you don't know that this is in a room where Raphael painted frescoes on four walls. Has anyone gotten to go there before? Anyone? Okay, I am jealous of all of you. I haven't yet, but I hope to. The Stanza della Signatura was where the Pope kept his library. And Accordingly, each of these walls represents a different realm of knowledge and literature. And so we have the Parnassus representing poetry and literature, and this has Homer and Virgil and people like that on it. We have the cardinal and theological virtues, which is on a wall representing law and jurisprudence. And then directly across from the School of Athens, and actually the first one that he completed in that room, is Disputation of the Sacrament. And this is basically the same idea as the School of Athens, but in the middle, we don't have Plato and Aristotle. In the middle, we have Jerome and Gregory and Augustine and Ambrose. And so look it up online. You can see other people there. Dante's in there, too. He gets to be on two walls. It's pretty special. But look it up and think about how you can work that in when you're studying the School of Athens. This is also a great opportunity as we're looking at the figures on the top. Many of them are depicted in traditional ways. If someone's holding, say, a key, students should know who that is. Who's going to have a key? Peter, right? If someone's got a harp, that's going to be David. If someone's pointing, John the Baptist. So students can start picking up on these, and then when you give them a new work of art, they go, oh yeah, he's pointing, so that must be John the Baptist. Okay, so let's move on from the Renaissance. Again, there's so many directions you can go, but one point here is just raising those questions about Christianity and classicism. Let's move on to the French Revolution. In 1789, the French Revolution began. Throughout the 18th century, France had been sinking into deeper and deeper financial problems for a number of reasons. Part of it was helping us in the revolution. At the same time, this was an era where the Enlightenment was filling the air with ideas about promises of a better society, established on reason with a capital R, characterized by liberty and equality and justice. And when you have widespread discontentment and when you have promises of we've got a plan for making things better, then those things come together oftentimes in revolution. And so this is the year that the Bastille was stormed. And this is also the year that on August 25th, the French Declaration of Rights of Man and of the Citizen was passed. Now, the French Revolution in some ways starts out on a pretty positive note over in America. Thomas Jefferson was watching what was going on, and you know, he actually contributed ideas to the French Declaration of Rights, and he was optimistic about the way that things were going to go. Maybe it would be a replay of 1776. But again, one of the high points is the writing of the Declaration of Rights of Man and of the Citizen. Now, such a grand occasion calls for a grand artistic celebration, right? And so Jean-Jacques François Le Barbier, who's ironically the official painter for Louis the 16th, was called to rise to this occasion. And this is what he created just weeks after it was passed. Now, this is another work of art that I show to my students and say, all right, this artist had 1,000 decisions to make about how he was going to create this. Let's look at the symbolism. Let's look at the technique and how that's set up. And why was it done like that? What is it communicating to us? And there's all kinds of symbols all over it. The eye at the top, the woman representing France, breaking her chains. But probably the most obvious is the shape that these are written in, right? Or rather, that these are chiseled in. It's the Ten Commandments, right? And in fact, when you look at previous art, like this Dutch piece from the 17th century, it looks a lot like the Ten Commandments was represented in art. Why would you do that? Obviously, you have something pretty dramatic to say about this document we've written, based on reason with a capital R, is either equal to or superseding this superstitious thing that we're kind of tired of and that we're ready to get rid of. And with France breaking her chains, it seems there's a new exodus that's about to happen as well. A new people being formed, maybe even a new enlightened humanity. And this is what's being communicated in this particular piece. Now, to some, that might sound good. Again, this is kind of the high point of the revolution. Nothing terrible has happened yet. The violence hasn't broken out yet, really, very much. And so this might sound pretty good. But as Christians, this would give us pause, right? I mean, writing a Declaration of Rights is one thing. Calling it the new Ten Commandments? That just has to provoke us to ask, where is this revolution heading? If this is what it's going to be, if these are the ideals that it's going to be based on, where is it heading? And unfortunately, as the months passed, the answer was not positive. When you think about the French Revolution, what's an object, what's an image that comes to mind that symbolizes it? The guillotine, right? And if you haven't you seen Francis Schaeffer's How Shall We Then Live? There's this recurring clip of the guillotine, you know, just going down again and again and again and again. And unfortunately, the leaders of the revolution became more and more totalitarian, paranoid, bloodthirsty. Anyone who is accused of disagreeing with the revolution or even not being enthusiastic enough to support it was often arrested, sent to be executed. Within a few years, something like 40,000 people, mostly peasants who hadn't really done anything, were sent to the guillotine. In addition to that, the September massacres and all of those terrible things. Even King Louis XVI and Queen Marie Antoinette were sent to visit what had been nicknamed the National Razor. So much for the ideals of the Declaration of Rights of Man. And then came de-Christianization. The goal of de-Christianization was to eliminate Christianity from French society. It represented superstition. It represented traditions, everything keeping the modern world from progressing into this new enlightened era of reason. Revolutionary leaders decided, you know, it's a lot more logical to have 10 days a week than 7, right? And so they changed the number of days in the week. And guess what? No more Sundays. Any streets that had the word saint in them were renamed. Oftentimes, churches were attacked or closed or turned into temples to reason. In one town, a crucifix was taken from a chapel and paraded about upside down for citizens to spit on. And we need a new way of tracking dates. So the beginning of the revolution is year 1, and we don't need to date things AD, BC anymore. And the goal of all of this was described by one revolutionary leader, Thurio, who proclaimed this, quote, "It is time since we've arrived at the summit of the principles of a great revolution to reveal the truth about all types of religions. All religions are but conventions. Legislators make them to suit the people they govern. It's the moral order of the republic, of the revolution that we must preach now, and that will make us a people of brothers, a people of philosophes." End quote. This new society would, of course, also need new heroes. And that's where Jean-Paul Marat comes in. By the early 1790s, Jean-Paul Marat had become one of the revolution's most notorious leaders. He was an inflammatory agitator. He had a newspaper called The Friend of the People. He was anything but the friend of the people because in any crisis, if there was a problem, he always had one solution: cut off more heads. And he was constantly publishing names of alleged traitors. He was turning people in. And every problem was met with that same solution, more violence. Then, in the summer of 1793, civil war was raging between supporters and opponents of the revolution. Of course, in France, not everybody supports the revolution. And a 24-year-old woman named Charlotte Corday came to Paris. Corday was disgusted at the turn that the revolution had taken. And yet here she was making her way to its very heart because she wanted to see one man that she believed to be most responsible for its worst violence, Jean-Paul Marat. She had come to Paris to kill him. She had originally hoped to make an example of him before the entire national convention, but unfortunately for her, that summer he was at home. He had this terrible skin disease, and he would soak in this medicinal bath. And he set it up kind of like an office, and people would come in and visit with him, and he would write, and he had this little desk thing. So when she needed to see him, that she had to go to his home. And she easily learned where he lived, purchased a simple kitchen knife with a 6-inch blade. She came to his home pretending to have a list of names of traders to give him. And when they were alone in the room, she pulled out the knife and plunged it into his chest. His friends ran in. It was too late to save him. She didn't even attempt to run away. Her whole plan was to give her life for her cause. And when she was asked at her trial, "Why did you do this?" she said, "I have killed one man to save 100,000. Unfortunately, her hopes were in vain. She might have killed Mara, the newspaper editor, but she had just unwittingly given birth to Mara, the legend, Mara, the martyr, Mara, the secular saint. The revolutionary leaders immediately planned for funeral ceremonies. He was embalmed. He was exhibited to the public in a church. Beside him were what would become relics, his desk, inkwell, paper, bloody clothes. Even his bathtub was put on display in the church. Afterward, there was a procession where these were brought down the street. They removed his heart, put it in an expensive urn, which was kept around. Later, he was entombed at the Pantheon in Paris alongside Voltaire and Rousseau. And at this point, we have to introduce the artist Jacques-Louis David. Jacques-Louis David was a revolutionary leader. He was also one of the greatest artists, if not the greatest artist in Europe at the time. He had made a name for himself with his neoclassical style, which soon was replacing the kind of frivolous, silly Rococo style that was prevalent during the years before the revolution. That's a good activity to do with students, comparing and contrast Rococo and neoclassical. But with these works like Oath of the Horatii and The Death of Socrates, he was reviving this classical interest in all things patriotic and heroic, and reintroducing themes like self-sacrifice. And Marat was able to actually spend 4 years in France studying classical art. He came back and he was just bursting with new ideas about how to create this new form of classicism and promote it. And this is, thus in 1793, he takes this new style, this neoclassical style, full of what we say the ideals were: patriotism, self-sacrifice, heroism. And he depicts Marat's death in that style. Now, the first thing that we need to notice is that when you compare this painting to descriptions of what actually happened, this isn't anything like it actually looked. When Corday plunged the knife into his chest, you can't see it on the screen right now, but the knife is actually on the floor. Okay, she didn't plunge it in and then take it out and drop it. She just left it there, right? It would have actually been sticking out in his chest. There would have been blood all over the place, right? Chairs overturned, a struggle. But what do we see instead? Looks like he's maybe taking a nap, right? There's a little bit of blood right there, and that's about it. He looks so peaceful, doesn't he? So what's our question? The artist has 1,000 decisions to make about how to depict this. Why like this? Well, to understand the answer to that, we have to know our art history. Remember, we just said David had spent 4 years in Rome. If you're an artist in the 1700s and you get a chance to go to Rome, there's a lot of great art there, but there's probably a short list of things that you absolutely have to see. And if you're interested in sculpture, you're probably going to make a point to see Michelangelo's Pietà. Can you see the similarities? And it's not just this particular sculpture, but it had been a tradition in Baroque art and other forms of art to depict Christ in this particular position. You can see the wound in his side. Where's Marat's wound? The kind of peaceful look, the way his head is turned, the way his arm is dangling down. Here's Caravaggio's entombment of Christ. So what is David doing in the death of Marat? He's turning Marat into a martyr for the cause of the revolution. He's turning him into a suffering Christ-like saint. After Marat's death, another revolutionary leader would offer publicly this prayer, quote, O heart of Jesus, O heart of Marat, you have the same right to our homage. O heart of Marat, Sacre Coeur, can the works and benevolence of the Son of Mary be compared with those of the friend of the people? Jesus was but a false prophet, but Marat is a god. Long live the heart of Marat. One of the important historical questions when you study the French Revolution is, yes, why did it turn out so differently than the American Revolution? Or maybe the English Glorious Revolution in the century before that? And that's a great question to explore with students. There's a lot of ways to do that. Here's Francis Schaeffer's answer for why it turned out so differently. He says, regarding the French revolutionaries, their base, consciously, was a purely humanist theory of rights. The Declaration of the Rights of Man sounded fine, but had nothing to rest upon. In the Declaration of the Rights of Man, what was called the supreme being equaled the sovereignty of the nation, that is, the general will of the people. And he goes on to identify the way in which the American and English revolutions rested much more so on a Christian Reformation kind of worldview, whereas the secular foundation of the French Revolution, which is more comparable to the Russian Revolution, didn't provide for that vision of human dignity and a biblical view of human nature, which is one reason it took such a violent route. So to wrap up with the French Revolution, here's a few ideas of things to discuss with students. First of all, just this is why you want to know your art history. You can't understand what David is doing if you don't know what he is taking and parodying, perverting even. Second, it's an interesting question to think about the nature of de-Christianization. They probably thought of themselves as turning away from religion and superstition toward reason with a capital R. But what are they actually doing? Are they actually becoming secular? Or are they forming a new religion to replace what was there before? And this could also maybe lead to questions about more modern times. You look at 20th century communist governments. How do they view their leaders? How do the North Koreans view, or how are they supposed to view their leader? How are the Russians expected to view Stalin? And what does this tell us about human nature? How about this? Is this a masterpiece? No doubt, Jacques-Louis David's one of the most talented artists who ever lived. What do we think of its message, though? If a student came in and said, guess what, I got the death of Marat, you know, I bought a print and framed it and put it over my bed, and you know, like, I'm glad you like art, but why that one? That would worry me. So just like all of the arts, though, I mean, we ask this question have you watched or heard of a film lately where talented director, you can't question their brilliance and just the worldview they're putting forward? Why can't they use their talent for something else? That's what I think whenever I look at Jacques-Louis David's. You know, so talented, why does it have to be this anti-Christian perversion of the gospel right here? But what is great art? What makes a masterpiece? Those are great questions to discuss as well. In the mid-1800s, Marat's reputation went downhill. Charlotte Corday became a hero. This is another depiction by Paul-Joachim Baudry from 1860. And this is an interesting comparison right here. Charlotte Corday is in the picture. Here he is writhing in agony. There's a chair overturned. It's messy. There's blood everywhere. So putting side by side two images of, you know, here's how one artist did it, here's how another, that can be good fodder for conversation as well. Okay, I want to talk just briefly about industrialization and the 19th century, and then we'll move on to a few activities that can be done with students. The Industrial Revolution, as you know, was a period of intense and rapid advances in technology that drastically and permanently changed how we live and how we work. Starting in Britain in the 18th century, quickly spreading to continental Europe and North America, the Industrial Revolution brought many farmers and artisans into factories to work, gave them machinery to operate. This is the first era of mass production. They're selling these products to larger and larger markets. What we're interested in here is the philosophical question of how it changes man's relationship with nature. Really, we shouldn't start with industrialization. We should start with the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution, because in some ways, the Industrial Revolution is a technological outworking of earlier ideas about progress and change and how we can figure out and manipulate and conquer the world for good or ill. But the question is, what did artists make of this? Okay, the last two examples, we've seen artists going along with major ideologies of the day. With the Industrial Revolution, as you'd probably expect from artists, we see artists resisting some of the changes brought about by the Industrial Revolution. J.M.W. Turner was one of the leading romantic artists. This is his Tintern Abbey. William Wordsworth wrote a poem, a few lines composed above Tintern Abbey. Those are kind of fun to talk about together. But with the advent of romanticism in literature and poetry and art, we have this new movement that is resisting industrialization and enlightenment and scientific revolution thinking by saying, rather than focusing on reason, how about our emotions? Rather than how we can conquer and control nature, what about how can we learn from and go back and re-experience nature? How can we find harmony with nature and truth in nature, not just build a factory and get rid of nature? And so one piece that is kind of fun to share with students is this one by J.M.W. Turner. And the first question for them is, what are we looking at? Does anyone know this one? Hannibal and his army crossing the Alps. Can't you see it? No, neither can I, really. If you look down here, you can see some people. Actually, the full title is Snowstorm, Hannibal and his Army Crossing the Alps. And what's interesting here is what would have in previous days been a great heroic image focusing on the great General Hannibal. Instead, the focus is on the snowstorm. And we happen to have a few people at the bottom. In fact, when you read Turner's account of how he came up with the idea for this, he actually witnessed a great snowstorm. And then he commented to a friend, I'm going to paint this. And also Hannibal's going to be in it. Sort of like an afterthought. Like, it's a conventional thing that you've got to, you know, it'll be more important if you put that in the title. And there's some interesting directions you can go with this one. Historically, just as kind of a side note to the whole romanticism thing, just a few years before, Jacques-Louis David, who, you know, the French Revolution has made way for Napoleon, and he's now working for him, and this is one of the great images of Napoleon, who also crossed the Alps, and Turner, being British, Napoleon being French, he's not going to be much of a fan, and so it's possible that Turner is maybe comparing Napoleon with Hannibal, and Hannibal is, of course, ultimately defeated, and Napoleon won't be finally defeated till 1815, but there's something of historical. Turner didn't usually do that, but something of historical interest there as well. Rain, Steam, and Speed, The Great Western Railway. I'm not going to talk about this one, but this is another interesting one. You know, how does he depict the train? Right, this, for the railroad's a new thing. You're an artist. How are you going to incorporate that into your image? And in this particular one, how does the train, how does the steam engine, how does it relate to what's surrounding it? One more romantic artist that I'm going to spend just a couple minutes on is Caspar David Friedrich. One of the great masterpieces to come out of Romanticism is Wanderer Above a Sea of Fog. We see the back of a man who has scaled a hill or a mountain. He's looking out over this valley covered in fog. And when I show this to students, I ask, what is Friedrich telling us about man's relationship with the natural world? And this is a great work of art because there's not really a clear answer to that. He doesn't explicitly say, that's part of the appeal, but we got to ask, what's this man doing here? Has he come to conquer? To discover? To worship? Is he part of nature? Or is he standing removed from it? Many of the Romantics believe that if you wanted to know truth, you don't look for it in a university library or a science laboratory or a church. You seek it in nature. Or if it's a church, you go find like rundown ruins of a church in the woods, and that's where you go. So again, what's this man doing? And what about the fog? The Enlightenment, Scientific Revolution, Industrial Revolution impulse wanted to clear away every mystery in the world and discover the inner workings of the universe. But in Romanticism's vision, maybe there's some mysteries we can't fathom. And maybe it's better that way. One more thing I'll add about Friedrich is that he was a typical Romantic in some ways, but he also considers himself to be a faithful Christian. And some of his religious art is, I think, inspiring. We also know, though, that he was influenced to some degree by the theologian Schleiermacher, the father of theological liberalism. And Schleiermacher had famously redefined faith as a feeling of absolute dependence. Feeling of absolute dependence. Doesn't that sound very much like Romanticism? Faith, for Schleiermacher, is something subjective and inward, not objective and grounded in reality. And when we see what Caspar David Friedrich had to say about the idea behind his painting, but behind his art, this is what he said. The artist should not only paint what he sees before him, but also what he sees within him. He said, a picture must not be invented, but rather felt. Close your bodily eye so you can see your picture first with your spiritual eye. Then bring what you saw in the dark into the light so it may have an effect on others, shining inwards from outside. Friedrich's art is very different than, say, Jackson Pollock or 20th century modernism, but you've got to at least ask the question, is he inadvertently paving the way for that? Or if you're a Christian and you say, I paint what's on the inside, maybe it's beautiful, what if you're a nihilist? So this is a real transition period in art. And so we see with Romanticism some of the ways that the Romantics are responding to not just what's going on at the time of the Industrial Revolution, but a lot of other things as well. Just as a side note, this is, if you've seen this work of art before but couldn't quite place it, it shows up on book covers a lot, from Frankenstein to Nietzsche to this top right one, John Lewis Gaddis, The Landscape of History, is a really good book if you teach history. White Identity. This last one, I don't know if you can see it, I can't figure out what the connection is. Jurisdiction and the Internet, Regulatory Competence Over Online Activity. Somehow it has to do with Romanticism. Maybe you can read the book and find out. And not only does it get used on book covers, but you can find all kinds of variations of it on books and comics and video games and movie posters, from Ursula Le Guin to Doctor Who to The Legend of Zelda, Inception, After Earth, Star Trek Into Darkness, and Marvel likes to use it as well. So again, interesting question for students. What is it that's so appealing about this this image, whether in Friedrich's composition of it or these other compositions. Another response to the Industrial Revolution besides Romanticism is realism. I'm not going to say very much about that except just to mention this piece right here, Gustave Courbet, The Stone Breakers. One of the major social concerns in the 19th century is, of course, the working and living conditions of factory workers and coal miners, and the common man, the common worker, was brought more and more to people's attention. This is also an age of revolutions, people seeking out either socialism or some kind of democracy. And so in art, we see that reflected as well, this interest in the common man. Courbet was walking down the road one day, and he saw these two guys breaking rocks. He said, "That's what I'm going to paint." And this wasn't previously considered something noble or inspiring or worth wasting a canvas on. But Courbet is doing that for a reason, and it relates to the time in which he lived. Another piece of his, The Burial at Ornon. There's some guy being buried. We don't even know who. At least the painting doesn't tell us. It's not very inspiring. It's not even that interesting. But that's the point. This is real life. And these are regular people. And how about I just paint what I see? Courbet said on one occasion, "Show me an angel and I'll paint one." Yeah, he's going to paint what he sees. All right, there's a lot of other eras you can talk about. The 20th century is great to talk about postmodernism and relativism and the wacky ways that modern art expresses that. I do want to talk about a couple of student activities. Let's get practical for a few minutes. So this is obviously one of those topics that's great for students to do presentations on. Assign them an artist, have them pick out a couple pieces of art, have them get up in front of the class, and basically be an art museum tour guide for a few minutes. Have them do some research on their own. And these are some of the most delightful presentations in my experience, because students often really get into the art that they're researching. Here's another activity that I've had some success with the past few years. I have students bring in a notebook. It can be just a regular spiral notebook. They can go get one of those fancy faux leather journals from Barnes & Noble. And we have a notebook that's exclusively dedicated to being our culture journal. Kind of like a commonplace book in some ways. But the idea is I'm going to give them pieces of art and questions, and then they're going to record their thoughts on that. And then as we go throughout the year, we get a larger and larger collection of things that they've written about great works of art. Here's one example. And I'd be glad to send you more of these if you're interested. Fragonard's The Swing. So this was the 18th one that we did. Give them about 10, 15 minutes. Just first start by describing it. Just observe. I read an article about a professor at some Ivy League university who would send her students out to an art museum, and she'd say, "All right, pick one work of art and look at it for about 2 or 3 hours and write about it." And the students were blown away with, at first it sounded like the worst assignment ever, but all these things started coming to life, and they actually enjoyed it. And I don't do that with my students, but part of the thing is just sitting and observing, and you start to notice things. And when you start to describe it, then you start to get it. What are some ways it exemplifies Rococo values and ideals? So we talked about Rococo art previously, so connect the dots with this particular piece. How does it relate to French culture, the pre-revolutionary period? So making that historical connection as well. Here's a photo of one student's. So they'll paste or tape the image in on one side of the page, and then they've got their response on the other. And some of them write a whole lot, some of them write a little bit, but over the year, they have a nice collection. I've got a couple other examples. I'm going to skip over that one, but you can also do this with music. We'll listen to Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, and again, make some connections with how this is a good example of Romanticism. Each movement is supposed to correspond in some way with something, and his visit to the country. We've also really enjoyed an annual tradition of taking a trip to the North Carolina Museum of Art, which is for us just about 20 minutes away from where we are. They've got a great collection of European art. The museum loves having us. They're really hospitable. I think they like having students coming in who know something about the Bible because so much art is religious. And when the tour guide talks about Moses, they know who they're talking about. A lot of museums will give free tours for students, and that's definitely worth checking into. If you're near D.C., be sure you don't just take them to the contemporary part. Decorate your classroom with great art. I like to switch out the art on my walls every quarter to correspond with the time period we're studying. If you've got access to a color printer, you can print stuff out, and it doesn't really cost much, if anything. Wikipedia is a great source for high-quality images. Not high-quality information, but high-quality images. So you can get a lot of good stuff there as well. Finally, one of the best pieces of advice I've ever heard as a history teacher was to just take things a year at a time. Okay, we can want to know everything at once, but if you pick out, you say, this year I'm going to talk about these works of art, then I'll pick out a few more next year, and just add a little bit at a time. It can be overwhelming. We're going to do everything this year. Well, no, we're not, and we can't, but we'll add a little bit each year, and it'll be good. So I want to close out by coming back to that question of why art should be important to us in the first place. Let me put it this way. Why do we listen to Handel's Messiah? Is it because it's a nice primary source that tells us something about the mid-18th century? Maybe. But I hope that the main reason we listen to Handel's Messiah is because we love it. And all too often in history classes, the study of art can become nothing more than just, here's one more primary source, right? We'll incorporate it into some kind of DBQ on an AP test, and you got to say something about it. Or it's just some biased, bigoted thing from the past, and we got to deconstruct it. But our goal is more than just academic. Art has the potential to transport us beyond ourselves, to help us see beyond our limited perspectives, to help us discover a beauty we didn't know was there. And ultimately, that's why we study art. The poet Dana Gioia said this, "All art is a language of color, sound, movement, or words. When we immerse ourselves in a work of art, we enter into the artist's worldview. It can be an expansive and glorious worldview, or it can be a cramped, dehumanizing worldview." This is where we have one more insight to gain from Schaeffer, simply from mentioning the title of his book. Schaeffer understood that the things we're talking about are not just some academic concern. This is a pastoral concern. How should we then live? As classical teachers, we want to introduce our students to great works of art and literature and philosophy from the past. As Christian teachers, we want to guide our students as disciples, to train them to take every thought captive to obey Christ. Last August, it was our first day back from summer break, and one of the seniors excitedly came to find me. She had spent part of her summer in Europe, and she just couldn't wait to tell me about it. "Mr. Hallbrook, we saw cathedrals. We visited all those places we studied in class. We went to art museums. I got to see some of the same paintings that we went over last year, and I recognized it, and it clicked, and it made sense, and it was great." And I thought, this is what we're after. Students who grasp a vision of history, who know and love what is beautiful, and who are in the process of learning to go out in the world and to truly understand what they see. Thank you.